Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, by ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for six-time Ironman world champion Dave Scott, by the IOA Run the City 5K coming up on Thursday evening, June 15th at Liberty Station. That's RunTheCity5K.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we just sent out 2,448 grants totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville and on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here in studio. Leslie Patterson and Simon Marshall, the authors of The Brave Athletes, Calm the F Down and Rise to the Occasion. How you both doing?
Great. Good. We finished the book. Of course we feel good.
Of course you do. Now, what? Give me the idea. Simon, you've been, obviously you guys are married. You've been working together. Simon's a PhD. Leslie's a two-time Xterra world champion and has done road triathlons, mostly dominant on the trails. What was the genesis of the book, Simon?
Well, it started really with, when I first met Leslie, she was 20 and really racing ITU and really not enjoying her sport at all. I was training as a sports psychologist, doing my PhD at the time, and I saw Leslie surrounded by sports scientists, exercise physiologists, and other folks who really didn't have much of a bedside manner with regard to coaching. And there I saw her really being treated as though she was a pair of legs and a pair of lungs and really not really listening to how you get the potential out of an athlete. So it was frustrating to me. And so she quit the sport. So there she was. We met, we started dating, and we were engaged to be married to a sports psychologist, and she gave up the sport. That's clearly not a good sign that I was very good at doing my job.
So Leslie, what was it about at that time? Obviously, you grew up as a rugby player. You're the only woman playing, or a kid, the only girl playing rugby with the boys. Age of 12 or so, at that point, the boys are getting bigger. You're not. And you move on to endurance stuff. What was it about the ITU style of racing and the coaching and the psychological stuff that was a problem for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, anyone that knows ITU knows that you have to be a very good swimmer.
Right.
And I mean, I'm a solid swimmer, right? 20 minutes for 1,500, that's not bad. But you have to be closer to 17 or 18 minutes. And so I spent a lot of time just working in the pool, working. And that kind of started to detract from what I really loved, which was being out in nature.
Right.
Not only that, all of the race courses are very much in the city. They're multiple laps.
They're flat.
Right. You know, they're not very exciting from a sort of nature standpoint. So I really felt like, I was always having to play to my weakness. And because I was spending all of this time in the pool, my biking and running got poorer and poorer. So I wasn't even good at that anymore. And then I just had a real low confidence. You know, certainly the coaching entities I was around, they would do things like ignore me if I had a bad race.
Really?
Oh, yes. And I mean, I'm talking, you're 15, 16 years old. And I had a lot of people tell me I just wasn't any good. So, that starts to grate on you,
right,
especially when you don't have the resources at that age to deal with it.
Sure.
So bit by bit, I just got very down on myself, anxious all the time, nervous, not really understanding why I was doing it. And so I had to just kind of give it up. And I remember when I did give it up,
How old were you?
I was 20 years old, and I just missed out on qualification for the Commonwealth Games for Scotland.
Which are huge.
Which are big. And I'd missed out by 0.05 of a second or something stupid. And, I just didn't love it anymore. And so gave it up, and I vowed never to do another triathlon. I mean, literally, I was like, I am never coming back to this sport. Yeah.
Did you move into another sport? Is that when you moved into Exeter? Or you basically gave up everything for a long time?
Yeah, gave up everything and went and I studied acting and drama, did my master's degree at San Diego State University.
Oh, that's right.
And just loved it. Essentially found my passion again for life, and started to understand who I was, how I ticked, really got into the, you know, because when you're studying acting, of course, you're getting into character development and understanding who you are and how does that apply to the characters you're playing. So it's almost like psychology, really.
Sure.
So when I delved into that stuff, I just kind of grew this, it grew who I was again, basically.
Right.
I re-established who I was. Because I'd spent so much of my youth being an athlete, and then when you
now
become
you weren't.
Now I wasn't, which was wonderful. But when I was at home, I was this quote-unquote failed athlete, and I walked around in those shoes for a long time. So
when you're here, you're at San Diego State, and people don't know you as an athlete. They know you as an actress. And I remember you jumping into the Dirt Dog series,
right?
And doing those totally for fun.
Totally.
Dominating, having a great time doing it.
Yep.
And Simon, at that point, she's moved away from sport except for recreational. So that must have been a little bit of a load off of your mind because you're not having to deal with... You're dealing with sports psychology with other athletes,
exactly.
But not having to take it home.
Exactly. And I think that for watching Leslie going on this journey where she rediscovered why she did sport in the first place, because doing the cross-country series in San Diego was very similar to how she started in the sport at 12 or 14 years.
Fell running and all that type of beautiful out
community,
there.
You know, people. I mean, you go to a dirt dog race and it's so fun. You know everyone.
Yes.
Everyone's just supportive. There's no aggro. It's just a good laugh, a good workout, and you won a prize of a bottle of beer or something like that, you know?
You go out for beer afterwards with your friends, and it's you against the course, you against yourself, and it's not anybody evaluating you and saying you had a bad race. Everybody's like, hey, great to have you here. We love having you here.
Right.
And the fire was lit. That's really what started it. So the fire went out in her stomach. You know, she's got an incredible passion for things that she decides that are important to her. And when she dropped out of sport the first time, it faded and she channeled it into acting and theater. And it was lovely to watch her have this enthusiasm back. And it was this unbridled, raw, innocent passion again. And to see someone be excited to race cross country when no one really knew her what she was doing, it was lovely to see because, you know, there's this person that you love dearly. And then you saw how sport had really squeezed every ounce of sort of passion out of her. And then she rediscovered it. And so that was just nice to see as a partner outside of my role as a psychologist. But it was lovely to see as a partner.
So then here's the Sextera, right? Which is it's swimming, but the swimming is not the most important thing.
No.
You got to ride the mountain bike. You've got to suffer, right? You're up at altitude. You're climbing. Then you've got to run off road. So it really fit not just your passion, but your talents.
Right.
And you had success there right away.
Right. I mean, literally the first race, you know, I was out there and interestingly enough, came out of the water in like second position with Michaeli Jones. Go figure, right?
Oh, yes. Really,
it goes to show you, right? You don't care anymore. And of course, you're effective.
Right.
So got on the bike, got to the front of the race, and I was like, wow, I'm winning this big race. This is awesome. I love this sport.
Yes.
And then, of course, you know, it was out in Temecula. It was about 100 degrees.
Yes.
I didn't drink. I didn't eat. I didn't sort of understand sort of the demands of Exterra, and got off the bike and started to run, cramped like a total bitch, and basically had to walk the whole run, and then I ended up coming 10th or something.
Nice. So. But what that led to eventually is you end up winning a world title, right in Maui.
Right.
And then, I mean, you win a world title, and I think that was a year Mally McQuaid cramped up.
Correct.
Towards the end of the race.
Right.
You passed her, and so then people go, well, she only won because Melanie melted down.
Right.
So now you come back as defending champion, and you win again. How important was that to you?
Huge.
It was huge, right?
Massive. I mean, that was everything, to be honest, because the first time was very much, you know, obviously it's amazing, you're elated, the whole bit.
Yeah.
Almost within a week of having won that, I got the negative notas, that's what I call them, you know, that sort of self-doubt and the expectation just coming down your shoulders and, you know, everyone's going to think I'm not going to be able to do it again. They think I don't really deserve it, you know, all those kinds of things. And I came out at the beginning of the following season just having some really terrible races.
Yes.
And I, you know, was going down that path of really hating it, like I had before, because of that expectation. And so Simon and I spent that summer, and I would say that's probably where the genesis of the book came from,
right,
was that summer, understanding how to take the pressure but still find the love and the purity of what you do, and have that come out during a massive race. Mm-hmm. And it did.
What I love about that is, I think there was, you know, obviously you had to, you win this, you know, that first one. And was that internal, where you thought, well, I don't know if I deserve this, or was it, because at this point you've got all the clutter and all the noise from the internet. People
right.
are like, oh, Melanie would have won.
Big
this
thing.
Or this. Were you hearing that,
yeah.
or was it more? Oh, it's okay. So that
both.
Was coming from outside.
Yeah,
both. So
both.
When you heard it from the outside,
yep.
you internalized it and said, "Well, they're right," because right. you're basically, your self confidence isn't quite there.
No.
So as the husband, mm-hmm. as the sports psychologist, how do you deal with that?
Well, it's funny, because watching her win that first title and under those circumstances,
yes.
and it's a brutal course. The
oh.
heat is dreadful.
Yes.
The humidity is hard, and it's a hard course. And then it was literally a week later starting to doubt it and watching her doubt it. And what this really struck home was that no matter what you achieve, it will never be enough. And that's sort of this mindset that, you know, you could win the lottery, right? You
right.
never have enough money. You can never, you win one title, you have to win two, you have to win three. So I think it's getting used to the fact that no matter what you achieve in whatever field you're in, that you'll get to that point mm-hmm. and you'll still want more. And I think that's quite an important point to recognize and to have the forethought to be able to say, you know what, I need to, one, enjoy the process. I have to enjoy the event for what it is now and enjoy the win for what it is now under whatever circumstances that was. And so for Leslie, it was also trying to get her to enjoy the fact that she was in this situation, she'd won this race, and even if it never happens again, because you still think that, right? You think, oh, I couldn't possibly do this again, it's going to be really difficult. But just to, rather than keep looking at the horizon and looking at the here and now and saying, look, how far you've come. Just 5 years ago or 6 years ago, you were hating sport. We went
yes.
to Oceanside to watch a friend of ours who was racing. And Leslie said to me, this is about 3 years before she started back into Xterra, she said, if I ever think of doing a triathlon again, please tell me. I never want to do this.
Yes.
And then 3 years later,
she's
it's her life again.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
And for yourself, Simon, what was your athletic background?
So I started as, like most English boys do, in football, soccer,
right. yeah.
And played tennis, and then got into cycling when I was 12 and started racing competitively at 12 in time trialing, as most
sure.
Brits do, and then was a Cat 1 road cyclist for many, many years and coached and raced. So I still had the experience of cycling, but never really the genetic talent, which is always the frustration. Probably
sure.
why I'm a psychologist, right? Figuring
right.
out why I didn't. So, but I knew the sport, and I knew, and I certainly saw colleagues of mine in my kind of era was Chris Boardman and
sure.
Graham O'Bree, and watching guys that really did have the talent move on, and then seeing the different personalities that it took to reach the top. And that's, I think, one of the myths that about elite athletes is that you think they're all kind of clones of one another, that they have this sort of untouchable mental strength or mental talent. And really, it takes all different personalities and all different sorts to make it. And Leslie, you know, when she was in between, after winning that first one and before she won the second one, she was still the same girl, really. She, you know, she had a little bit more confidence, but she was still pretty shy and doubting and worried and so
right.
on. And I think that also, in my training in sports psychology, you know, it was really great to be, the best thing you can do as a sports psychologist is to be married to a professional athlete, because you get to peek behind the curtain of what the textbooks don't tell you.
Right.
And you learn to change the way that you do psychology, because you see that these athletes like Leslie and others struggle in exactly the same way as we all do. It's just that they've, you know, had a better hand in the genetic lottery than the rest of us.
What's interesting is when you were speaking the other day at the Challenge Athletes Foundation building, we had our paratriathlon camp in town, and you were talking about the chimp brain. Mm-hmm. you know, in the three different brains, the chimp brain, the professor brain, and what's the other
one? Computer.
The computer
That's
brain,
right.
Yes.
All right, come on. It'll be a test.
Yes. I don't have a computer. So the interesting part, I started thinking back to, you know, different interviews I've done over the years and different things I've watched. Mm-hmm. And I remember interviewing Mark Allen once, and he was Mark was always a very insightful guy, right? Mm-hmm. He was always a guy who analyzed things. And this was a time when Mike Pigg was one of the best guys and was starting to beat Mark. And there was an article that came out in Sports Illustrated about Mike. And I remember Mark telling me, he says, you know, it's fortunate that I was at a really good place, that I was, you know, I was doing well in, you know, in Ironman and doing well in other events, because I could have looked at that article two different ways. It could have been, why did they do that on Mike and not on me? You know, you sort of been sort of the insecure guy, mm-hmm. or that's really good for the sport that they did this article on Mike. And that's where he came from. But he understood that he could have been at that other place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the other moment that I remember was I was over at Ironman Germany, and this guy, I was working for ESPN, and this guy, Lothar Leader, mm-hmm. before the race, he had his stocking cap on. He looked like a deer in the headlights. He had, you know, before, this is like an hour before the race starts. It's dark out. We're in Roth, Germany. He's got a flat tire. He looks totally out of control. He's running around back and forth. I'm going, this guy will not be a factor today, right? You're basically chimp brain. This guy's like, yep. Oh my God, what am I going to do? He became the first guy to go under 8 hours that day. So you're looking at him and going, this guy's out of control. He's wasting all this energy, and he was able to get it together. And but you mentioned that the day before race, I think Leslie might have mentioned it. The day before race, you tended to melt down, right?
Yeah, big time. That's part of my process, you know, and we call it chimp purging, where essentially you're exhausting. Your chimp is your limbic system, right?
Right.
And, you know, that fight or flight thing.
Well, sure.
Sometimes you just need to exhaust that damn thing so that it settles down. And so the day before a race, you know, generally I'll fall apart and I'll just rant and rave for a good 2 or 3 minutes. My chimp gets exhausted. I kind of laugh about it and then I can move on, and that's all settled, and I can, you know, sort of become Leslie the athlete again.
Now, did you learn that from Simon, where Simon was able to identify that
and
say,
absolutely.
Yes.
No. because a lot of people, I've seen people the day, and we'll be over in Kona, and we'll see a defending champion the day before the race, like throwing stuff and out of control. And, you know, I mean, one time in particular, they didn't start the race. It turned out that, you know, they were sick, but they didn't know it, and it came out that night.
Right.
But so for you, Simon, you knew what was going on. Obviously, it had happened a number of times.
Right.
When you were able to point that out to Leslie, then was it something that you end up not taking it personally? Because I'm sure when she's ranting, she's going, this didn't happen and you didn't do this. And how did you?
I think for Leslie, you know, one of the big realizations for me being married to a professional athlete is, and this is sort of one of the common dynamics that's happened in our relationship, is that Leslie has said, but this is what I do and this is what I find works. And
and
I'll reflect on it and say, well, actually, this is why the psychology of what you're saying, I couldn't have even dreamt of that strategy that you've come up with, Leslie, but this is really why that works, and giving her a framework. And once we kind of have this mental model, and ours is that we've borrowed, there's no new psychology in a way, is really to have a framework for understanding how your brain works. And on race day, you've got a fight going on in your head, and we talk about the chimp brain or the limbic system, and this is that emotional you battling with the rational, logical you. And different athletes get their different places. Some athletes are very analytical and very focused, and there's very little emotion in their preparation. It's clinical. And other athletes are all piss and vinegar. Some of them are angry. Some of them are emotional.
Yes.
Some of them are very talkative. And I think the goal here is not so much one is right or wrong, but really having them in harmony on when you actually come down to doing what you're doing. So they're not fighting one another. So one is either receding or giving up control to the other kind of brain. And for Leslie, it was that she really was, she was quite an analytical person, but she really was emotional, and she really sort of self-doubted herself. And when she found this part of, and she developed a strategy that we call developing an alter ego, which mm-hmm. has some good psychology behind it. I would never have dreamt of it being called that, certainly not in the sports psychology textbooks, but It's really saying that, listen, if I can't find my athletic identity, the kind of person I need to be on the day, because that's the person I think I need to be aggressive and have the fight in me, and that's so different to my actual personality, well, why don't you just fake it? Why don't you just create an identity for yourself so that you can get into that character? So this is really when you're saying, look, my chimp is giving me negatives, but I can, my chimp is also my friend. It can be strong and positive and trying to keep me alive. And how do I channel that into something more positive? And so Leslie found this strategy for doing that, and we called it developing an alter ego.
Yeah.
So you've got that sort of a pattern when you were racing, that the day before you'd melt down.
Yep.
Were there times where she didn't melt down and the day is going on, it's a day before the race, and you're thinking, is she ready for this race? Yeah. She seems like she's pretty calm. Were there times like that?
Yeah, definitely. And what's interesting is I would almost, not self-sabotage, but I would create a moment of drama so that I could almost
so you
have
could let that chimp out. Because you needed to, right? It was part of the pattern.
Yeah, totally. Like things, whether it was
Forgetting
my goggles, or having a, you know, some kind of mechanical that I didn't really need to have, you know, or something like that.
Falling off the bike.
Right,
exactly. Something, yeah.
Yep,
you just needed something dramatic so that you could deal with it and basically
and
vent.
Let it go. Yep.
So on race morning, I think you mentioned that you'd have your hoodie on.
Yep.
You'd have your, you know, just focus straight ahead, your headset going.
Yep.
Just so that you focused, you didn't let any other energy in.
Right. And that's because, you know, your eyes and your ears take so much information, and that's fed directly to your chimp.
Yeah.
And that can have a huge impact on how you feel. And so controlling those elements are really, really key. And then also as well, becoming that alter ego for me, a huge part of that is having that focus, having that stare. You know, there's certain behaviors that my alter ego has. So on race morning, I start to adopt some of those character traits. But, you know, again, it's actually really pretty tough because it is almost like acting in so much as, you know, I'm a known athlete out there. So I have a lot of amateur athletes that will come up to me and talk to me, or you have to do things in front of the camera. So you constantly have to kind of put on this face and then kind of switch back to your alter ego, then put on this face, then back to the alter ego, you know. So that takes a lot of practice.
I remember talking to Craig Alexander after, you know, he won the Ironman a couple years in a row and ended up winning three of them. And I'm like, well, you know, when you come to Kona, and I'm sure it's the same thing when you go to Maui and you're defending champion, right? Everybody wants to talk to you.
Sure.
And he said, but that's why I do this sport.
Right.
If I came here and they didn't want to talk to me, that's a problem.
Big time.
So I plan that into my schedule, knowing that I'm going to do X number of interviews, and I'm ready for it, and I don't let that affect me.
Right.
Is that what you would try to do?
Yeah, definitely.
Too?
And it is now, and I think, but when you first wear those shoes, that's difficult to deal with.
Sure.
Certainly, when you first wear those shoes, you're not sure if you own them. And so you are like, all these people want to talk to me, but do they really think I'm that good? Do I deserve it? Yeah. And now I'd say I'm in that position. I've been through so much with injury and illness and all sorts that, you know, I'm really grateful for that. You know, I was out doing a local Xterra race on Saturday. Xterra Renegade. And it was wonderful just meeting and chatting to all the local people and just all the athletes.
No pressure, just having fun.
Yeah. You know, and that's a huge part of why I do this sport, is a social community. So, yeah, it's
good. Does it get to the point? I mean, so here you went through this where you had the negative experience as an ITU guy. Then you jump into sort of casual doing the Dirt Dog series. Then casually getting in, not casually, you get in the Xterra, and all of a sudden you're riding with McKeely Jones, who's, you know, Olympic silver medalist and Ironman world champion and Xterra champion. And how quickly did you go from, this is fun, this is recreational, this is a good time, to, I am Leslie, the hardcore, I've got to win athlete again?
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Once I tasted it, it was like, okay, that was it. I remember when I first saw Xterra, and I had that thing in my belly, you know, where you're like, you know what? I can do this. I can be really good at this.
Right.
Yeah, so it was quick.
God. So in the book itself, again, the book is called The Brave Athlete, Calm the F Down and Rise to the Occasion. And 13 most common mental conundrums. Not often you see conundrums. athletes face in everyday training. And I'm sure when you say training, you mean racing.
Yeah, training well. And racing.
Training
yeah,
and racing. So as a guy who was a Cat 1 cyclist and you work with the BMC guys, the top level, were you surprised when some of these guys were like, doubting themselves, like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. I haven't done the training. This guy looks fitter. We see these guys as gods.
Yeah.
Right? They are at the top. It's one thing with our triathletes. These are guys who are making $1 million a year, right? Yeah. These are the top guys in the world in endurance sports. And are they the same?
It's incredible, you know. That was one of the big realizations for me last year, spending time at the Tour and the Tour of Switzerland and all the pre-training camps and listening to some of the top riders, and they have all the same issues as, you know, everyday yeah. athletes. They came, they've obviously started as juniors and right. age group athletes, and they came through, and someone like Richie Port came through triathlons.
So. Yes, that's right.
So, while they don't necessarily struggle with some issues that other athletes deal with, like some of them, you know, confidence isn't probably an issue with them. Some of them are overconfident.
Sure.
But they still deal with problem with expectations, meeting expectations, the pressure, worrying about contract renewals and that sort of stuff. And they very much are aware that the world's media's eyes are on them. And I think it's
all the time. Yeah.
And they are. And they're worried about screwing up. They're worried about not performing to their ability. Mm-hmm. And I think that and this is the same with Leslie and some of the other top triathletes that we work with. It's the same thing. These problems are pretty endemic. They're pretty universal. And I think for once more and more people see that the top athletes struggle with pretty much the same stuff as everybody else, it's sort of nice because no one really talks about that. I mean, these guys aren't going to certainly admit it on camera. And,
no.
and I think a lot of top triathletes aren't going to openly talk about how they...
They don't want to show weakness.
No.
You're never going to show the other guys.
It's something that I do all the time with my athletes, you know, and they'll be like, you're nervous before a race. You have to go to the bathroom, you know, 5-6 times. You know, you worry about what people think. And I'm like, hell yeah, I do.
Right.
And so it just makes them feel that much, you know, better about it. Well, if she's achieved that and she goes through those same things, well, maybe I can achieve more than I think is possible.
We tell this story. Yeah. Leslie was in Escape from Alcatraz 2 years ago, and she was out in the swim, and she started crying during the swim.
I don't blame you. It's cold. It's choppy. There's like not one buoy out there.
Right? It's awful.
She can't see where she's going. She's swimming it. She's getting the kayak tap on the head. You're swimming in the wrong direction. And she's crying.
Brutal. Oh, I'm sure you're thinking you're going to drown.
I know. What am I doing? And then you tell other athletes this, and they're gobsmacked. The fact that here you are as a top pro tip to podium in the race, and you're actually having a bit of a meltdown and crying. Right. Like a little girl or a little boy out in the race.
I remember talking to Chrissy Wellington, and she was, remember, trying to be an ITU athlete.
Yeah.
And she was thinking she was ready for the big time. And she told her parents, you need to come down and watch me do this race in London. And I think it was London. And so she got a wetsuit. She borrowed a wetsuit, a little too big for her. And she jumped into the water, and basically the thing filled up, and she never started the race. They had to save her at the beginning of the race. A woman, she just invited her family and watch me. I'm going to win this race. And she never got started the race. So, and I remember Mark Allen telling me this story once. He was at a race, and he's, you know, walking. He comes out of the porta potty, and he's got number one on, and it's just everybody's staring at me, and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm Ironman world champion, and they're staring at me. I'm wearing number one. I'm the best in the world. And some guy goes, hey, Mark, you got toilet paper on the bottom of your shoe.
Brilliant. Awesome.
So it's that type of stuff where these guys are human, right?
Yeah.
And most of our guys, Mark Allen was, thought he'd be, was going to become a doctor. Dave Scott was a swim instructor. None of these guys went into this going, I'm going to be a professional athlete, same as you.
Right.
I'm going to be a professional athlete and make a living doing this. So there's always sort of this question in the back of their mind going, I fooled them for a long time.
Right.
And now people are going to figure me out that I'm
not
really that good. And the next generation, next guys are coming in and they're going to knock me off. So that insecurity seems like it's always there. When you're working with age groupers, and then the other thing that I remember Paula telling me from one of her multi-sport camps, a lot of times they would ask these athletes about their training. Mm-hmm. And here's an athlete who's a parent, an employee, you know, has a company,
Yep.
And, you know, three kids at home, a husband, a job, and they're training 50 hours a week as age group triathletes, right?
Right.
They're doing more mileage in swim, bike, run than Paula was doing.
Right.
Do you guys find that these guys sort of, you have this pro age group person who's burning it at not just at both ends of a candle, like in the middle as well, and they're just totally setting themselves up to fry and be out of the sport.
And that's where it's very important to get to know your athletes as person, you know, as people, so that you can talk to them about their lives, understand where they're coming from, and, you know, understand their backgrounds and why they're making these decisions and really ask the right questions.
Sure.
So, you know, if someone's passionate and they want to spend that amount of time, you ask them why, and you try and talk them through sort of the physiology of the benefits of what they're doing and the downfalls of what they're doing, and you know, it's just, again, questioning their motivation. So it's really getting to the bottom of why they're doing what they're doing, and then you know, understanding their family dynamics, understanding their business, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's just getting to know the entire package.
When I watch you race from, you know, passion, and you just go hard, right? You go hard from the beginning. In fact, that was one of the things I always looked at you as an athlete and thought, I wonder if she's going too hard too often in training and sort of burning yourself out,
definitely.
Right?
That's,
I remember McKeely telling me that once.
Says, all the time.
Says, if I could coach Leslie, it would be less is more. You know, don't go hard at it, because you can't go to the well that often, right? You burn yourself out. But when you were racing, you know, is sometimes knowledge, having too much knowledge, because you know all of his stuff now. Were you racing sometimes thinking, okay, my chimp brain, and I've got to deal with my professor brain, and I've got to deal with my computer brain, and turn my brain off and just race?
You know, I'm pretty good at just doing that, to be honest.
Okay.
I really am.
Yeah.
And I think the last 4 years, you know, and that's why I talk about the genesis of the book coming from that summer. You know, I've really, over the last 4 or 5 years, dealt with a lot of, as I've said before, illness and injury. And a lot of that has come about because of overtraining and doing too much. And so I've really spent a lot of time analyzing why. Why did I feel the need to do that? And a huge part of that was because my success came from all of
that
volume.
All that hard training,
all that hard training. And so my lack of confidence told me that if I didn't do that, I really wasn't that good, because I'd always been told genetically I wasn't actually that good, and I figured, well, it's just my
I'll work people
right.
And I think that's quite the important point here, because Leslie's, you know, entire athletic career, she'd been told her lab data was you're kind of average and you're not that spectacular, but you get out, this is kind of the market.
You've got an engine,
right.
You've got you can go hard, you're a diesel, you can go long and hard.
Well, and also, but out in the real world, you've got something special, but when we try and isolate it physically, we don't really see it. It's like Mark Cavendish, right, as a road sprinter. He's quite average as a laboratory rat, but when you get him out there, he's phenomenal. And so some athletes are able to cope really well in sort of the messy real world of competing, and other athletes don't. And so I think Leslie it was really hard for the sports science coaches to understand that personality and what brought that out. And I think for Leslie, trying to figure out, well, I know, and this is her kind of one of her sort of more deep-seated insecurities, or it was as she developed as an athlete, was thinking, well, I'm not probably that genetically talented, so I just have to outwork everybody. I have to outsuffer everybody. And there's a quiet confidence that comes with looking across the start line and knowing that I've outworked you, outtrained you, and I will outsuffer you. And that's intimidating as a competitor. But that mindset also can be your undoing as well. So,
but I will say this. I always remember Alistair Brownlee saying in one of his quotes, I would rather have 2 or 3 years of spectacular results than, you know, and then get injured than have 8 years of mediocrity.
I agree.
So, you know, there's something to be said for that. And, you know, and it was my coach at the time, Vince Ficera, that kind of switched my training around. And, you know, he's a big advocate of volume and what have you. And so that was a huge part of my success. But, you know, obviously, looking back on it, I mean, and we talk about this in the book, exercise addiction.
Well,
there is such a thing.
Well, no question about it. Two quick stories on that. Alberto Salazar, if you look at Alberto, top American marathoner, right? And he set up he wanted to double at the 84 Olympics in the 10,000 and the marathon. So he set up a 10K with Henry Rono and all the top guys up at Hayward Field in Oregon the week before Boston. right? And pouring rain, similar to today, they ran like 27s mid, right? And Alberto got leaned out by Henry Rohn then. Then he goes the following Monday and wins Boston. Then he, over that summer, I think he set world records and American records at 5,000, 10,000. Mm-hmm. And then in November, won New York City Marathon. And basically his career was over. Right, he had probably six world-class performances over 6 months.
Right,
and so it's almost the smoke them if you got them. Mm-hmm. You're healthy,
right,
and you never know if you're going to have that type of form again.
Yep.
So do you wait and hopefully stretch it to the next year, or do you smoke them when you got them? You go for it now because you never know.
Yeah,
that makes it really, really tough.
It does, and you know. There was a turning point in my career when I can see that things just kind of started to fall apart.
Yeah.
You know, I lost a lot of weight. And as a woman, that's really tough because...
And you don't weigh anything anyways.
Right. You know, but I mean, I weighed more before. But unfortunately, I lost a lot of weight and then won 3 world titles. So what does that tell you in your mind, you know, that that's important? So then you start to get obsessed about that. We speak also about, you know, body image issues and, you know, disordered eating and things like that in our book, because that's a really critical part of the triathlon community right now. You know, and I speak to more and more, especially professional female athletes that struggle with that. You know, they have issues with fertility, hormone issues. I mean, honestly, if you speak to most of the top female athletes, probably none of them have menstruated in several years.
Right.
You know, because that's the trade-off, you know.
You want to be the best. And you've
right. And body weight plays a role. So it's you know, there's so many issues like that can impact your longevity in the sport.
What's fascinating is a number of years ago at the Ironman Sports Medicine Conference, their topic was bone density.
Right.
And they did research with the guys who were there to do Ironman and the women who were there to do Ironman. And the men's bones were like rocks. The women had huge issues because most of them hadn't been menstruating since they were very young.
Right.
And they'd been athletes for a long, long time. So it became a huge issue.
Right.
So it's, you know, there are problems out there. Now, one of the things that's funny, I was out at the race today, and we had kids out there racing, which I love. I love seeing that. And the triathlon, the San Diego Sprint today San Diego Sprint race through CAS Events, I think it's 1,650 people. It's like the biggest
amazing
event they've ever had.
Yeah.
There was a fair number of kids out there, and you see some of the parents on the side of the road screaming at them, and it's like, okay, you want to enjoy. I mean, it's great that the sport has become kid-centric, and we get kids in it, but then you get Little League parents in there as well, and similar stuff to what you didn't go through it with your parents, but you went through it with the coaches who put it in your head that you need to lose weight. You need to, your body image got affected by your racing as a young girl.
Definitely. And I mean, look at it now. It's so hard with kids given social media.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of. Yeah. And again,
bullies,
we talk about this. We have a chapter in the book about, you know, impression management.
Right.
You know, it's so tough. Everyone's taking pictures of themselves. Don't I look great? This and that. All of these comments, all of these selfies.
Sure.
And so that feeds into that, you know, that narrative. And it's an absolute challenge. We deal with it with our athletes all the time, and especially our young athletes
I think, you know, some of the research on this has looked at, you know, what is it about endurance sport and triathlon in particular that sort of seems to attract a certain personality?
Right. Well, now, addictive personality.
Well, neurotic personality, prone to anxiety and lots of other things. And does the sport sort of create or engender that? Or do people with those characteristics gravitate to those sports? And the conclusion is that people who are like that gravitate towards those sports. So
no question.
Triathlon does have quite a remarkable incidence compared to other endurance sports of disordered eating and eating disorders and body image, body dysmorphia and some of the other conditions, as well as neuroticism and anxiety. So it's and we know that the children of parents like that, these are contagious as well. And so And that parenting style will probably translate through the, some of these sports. And so there is an issue, particularly as we go longer and harder to be successful. You know, we look at the prevalence now of ultra running, and it really is only what's the next challenge that can test human endeavor.
Tough
right?
Mudder, Spartan race, right. It's harder, longer, tougher.
The warriorization of our sport.
Yeah.
And there are some triathletes turned sociologists, like Scott Tinley is a good example, who's written about this quite extensively, and it's a fascinating to see, well, where this is enjoyable and it's fun, but where is this leading us culturally? And I think some of those issues don't get talked about, and they're certainly not evident when you go to races, because you're just seeing people enjoying themselves and being out there and having fun. But I think there's some of these other bigger discussions about what, where the sport's going and how this leads to character and where it leads to sort of more responsible.
You know, it's so fascinating now. You know, I'll have some of my athletes that, you know, go, they prepare for their Ironman, they're very dedicated, and then they do their race, they've had a great race, they PR, and then 3 days later
they're upset.
You know, it wasn't good enough, and I want to be better, and, you know, oh my goodness, and you know, that sort of
up.
Yeah, it's a really, and most of us are like that, you know, so finding a place for mindfulness and gratitude is a huge piece of how to continue to enjoy the sport, you know, long term.
Simon, one of the things you were saying when you mentioned Scott Tinley years ago, I remember I had Scott Tinley and Scott Molina during an interview together with the two of them. And there was a point there where those guys were training together on a daily basis, and they put a gap of between them and the rest of the triathlon world of, you know, 3 to 5% that lasted for most of the decade of the 80s. And both of them admitted that, you know, Molina was sort of going through a tough time at home, you know, with his wife at the time. And so, and then he did enough sport-specific research to realize that the top swimmers were swimming 30,000 meters a week. And the top cyclists were riding 300 to 400 miles a week. And the top runners were running 80 to 100. So he decided that if I want to be the best in this new sport of triathlon, I'll just put them all together and I'll train 40 hours a week. And Tinley's like, since I wanted to be the best, and I needed to do what he was doing. So those guys put that gap on the rest of the world. But, you know, Tinley ended up having adrenal issues. He ended up having his hip resurfaced. Molina had back issues. They put that gap. But they were guinea pigs. Nobody knew about this sport.
Right.
It's not like there was running, which had been around forever, or swimming, or cycling. How have, when you look at the sport, and we've gone through a couple generations now, how has it changed in terms of how people look at the training? And are we still doing this massive mileage, or we've moved back to, there's always this mileage or intervals and mileage and speed, or less is more, or more is more. What do you see now, Simon?
Well, I think, you know, in defense of some of the sports science on this, this is really where we need to lean on the scientific research to show what methods are more effective. And then some of the studies that show what the likelihood of getting injured is and the recurrence of injury. But I think culturally, and, you know, talking as a psychologist, I think this is more fascinating about what is it that we find endearing or attractive or motivating about these very arduous long-term tests of human spirit, human willpower. What is it about those? And, we see it, as you said, in Spartan racing and Tough Mudders and some of the and Ironman distance athletes. And I think that alone is quite an interesting thing to consider. And maybe it's the fact that you're being more sort of a self-reference competition. So now it's not really one-on-one head-to-head competition as it would in short course or very fast racing. It's now just about the coping, it's a self-battle. It's how you can, whether you can endure, whether you can keep going. And so, I don't think so much we'll have any of the answers to these things. But I think that as we start to look at the effects of, 10, 20 years of these sorts of events on our generation now and on the kids who are coming through, we'll start to probably shift as well in perspective. And there'll be, things go in cycles. And this isn't about the volume and intensity argument. This is more just about the types of events that people are being hooked on and doing on a regular basis.
I think it's always, finding a combination of everything, right? And I think that it's about stimulating your body and your mind in different ways, but at the same time paying attention to what impact that has on your body and mind. And that's the hardest thing, because you'll go through these cycles of training, whether it's intensity, whether it's volume, whether it's both.
Sure.
And you get addicted to that sensation, right?
Oh,
and you
absolutely
get obsessed
feel great.
With it. Right, yeah. Right. And so it's understanding at what point is it being a detriment to your progression, and you know, at what point it's you know, building up your character. You know, I'll have mental toughness training days, which are less almost about the physiology of what's occurring in those days.
Yes.
And it's more about, you know, putting something on the table that seems unattainable, and you get it done. And what does that build with mental confidence? But you therefore then need to back that up with rest and recovery so that you can absorb it physiologically. And in the past, I've not been able to do that. I'll have a day like that and I'll want to keep repeating it. And it's the same with other athletes. So it's understanding that there's a role for all of that in your training, but there's also a mental impact of all of that. And then there's an addiction to all of that. So it's, you know, it's really tough.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that I think a lot of athletes go through, so you have success. You win Xterra a couple years in a row, Xterra World Championships, you're winning races. And but at the same time, you know, your body's changing, you're aging a little bit.
Yep.
But you want to do what's been successful.
Right.
And then it's then all of a sudden you start finding that I can't string those quality days together.
Sure.
That I used to string together.
Yep.
There's something wrong with me, rather than, you know what, I'm aging a little bit. I've been in the sport for a while. Maybe I need to take more time off. How tough is that balance with, because you doubt yourself. You go, this is what I did before to be successful. Yep. I can't do that now, therefore I can't be successful.
Right. I think it's understanding that the whole thing is cumulative,
right,
across year upon year, and it's cumulative physically and it's cumulative mentally. So the place I'm at now, I've got years and years of pace behind me.
Right.
I don't need to keep doing more and more and more of it to get the same stimulus.
Right.
And furthermore, I have so much more mental toughness and maturity as an athlete,
right,
to be able to stand on the line with a different level of confidence. So what I bring to the table now is just different. But equally, I think that if, as an athlete, you've been to the rock bottom, which I have been, where you can't get out of bed or sitting down is painful.
Now, was this when you were doing ITU stuff or more recently?
No, more recently. Yeah.
Was this Lyme?
From Lyme disease, and then which created a whole host of injuries.
Yeah. How long was you figure that out? Because I'm sure your body's weak.
Yep.
You don't know what's going on.
Yep.
And you don't, your first thought is, I'm just weak, right? Or I'm just a little overtired. But you don't think you have a disease of some sort.
No, and I think you push through it because of my mentality.
Right.
You just keep going and you dig yourself a bigger and bigger hole.
Right.
And the nature of this disease is it's very up and down. So, you know, you can get moments of clarity where you're, you know, the world champion, you know, you can be, and then other moments where it's just impossible to even function. So, you know, but again, I think that's given me an amazing sort of sense of gratitude about the joy that is in this sport, what we have, what it's about, the community of it, learning and growing about yourself through it, realizing that those downs are a way to learn more about yourself, which is ultimately,
sure,
I think, actually why we do the sport. Yeah, and then when you do get success, really reveling in it. So it's kind of both a blessing and a curse,
a little
right?
bit of a curse. And how is Simon dealing with that when she's not just down about it herself because she had a bad training day, but she's dealing with you know, Lyme disease. She's got something there that, you know, you can't really do anything about it, right? In the psychological part,
right,
isn't really going to help her deal with that disease.
It really isn't. And so, you know, this is really about identity. And so identity, you know, from a psychological perspective, is about the thoughts and feelings that you have about yourself and what you're good at and what you can do. And I think we all have multiple identities. You know, Leslie has an identity as an athlete, but also as a wife and a daughter and a business owner and so on. And they all feed into, you know, your overall sense of self, your self-concept.
Sure.
And so if any of these things go away, or if you've put all your eggs in one basket, so people who are really one-dimensional athletes, particularly a professional, so they live and breathe as
yes.
an athlete. And when that goes through traumatic, through from injury, through
age, whatever,
whatever,
yeah.
it really leaves a big vacuum. And so Leslie has always tried to have other aspects of her life nurtured. And so this has been a criticism of her as well, is that, oh, if you stop the film stuff and all the other stuff, you just focus on the sport, just focus, you'd be better. Yeah. And really, while that might be true in some of the preparation stuff, how you think and feel about racing, I think for her, it's about nurturing a bigger sense of herself, because when sport is over for her as a professional, it'll never be over for her as a person.
Cause sure.
She'll go to the grave
sure.
competing.
Of course.
I think that that really is sort of self-medicating for her in a way. She's really shoring up that other parts of her personality. So that's really nice to see. When I find Leslie focusing on other aspects of her life, even at the detriment of her sport, meaning that there's time away from her sport, mm-hmm. it's really healthy, and I like to see that. And that's what's most frustrating about some athletes. Well, not frustrating, but it's athletes who are worried, or you can see them heading down a really large black hole, and they don't know it at the moment, but it is coming to them.
Right.
And we've got lots of studies to show that athletes who do this are headed for, you know, mental health issues, and they lose a sense of identity once that goes, because they don't have anything. Then they've probably sacrificed, education and other things, other skills that they could
families.
Have. Families. Exactly. Divorce is prevalent.
Oh, I know.
So I think that trying to have other aspects of yourself to create that all feed into your overall self-concept is really important. And that doesn't have to be a detriment to your physical preparation.
One of the things that you see when you talk about couples, right? If one person is totally into this stuff, you know, and the other one really could care less, that's hard, right? Yeah. And I see it when I travel. I see usually couples are, like, you know, fit or fat, right? You see a couple mm-hmm. where the guy and the gal are both, you know, not in great shape, not in any type of shape, or both of them are pretty fit. And then very rarely do you see one person who's really in great shape and then their partner who's not in any way, shape, or form into what they're into. You mm-hmm. see much of that with some of your athletes?
All the time.
All the time, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's less about physical conditioning and more about the mindset and support that one has
right.
for each other's life.
Yes.
So I think that when the challenge is when you have couples who one person just simply doesn't get it, why you spend so much time doing this, what seems to be a fairly pointless activity.
And selfish. Yes.
And that's where you run into more problems. Now we know lots of couples who are one is completely out of shape, and the other one's in shape, but there's a mutual respect for each other's passions and disciplines, and that's usually not a problem. But when there's the lack of support or resentment or envy that comes up with that you're spending all this time.
And you're with all these other people.
And you're with all these other people.
Who share the same love and passion and feed into your feeling of self-worth.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the other person doesn't feel that self-worth and sees you getting all this, you know, all these people, you're being bombarded with, you're great, you're great, you're great, and you're on the outside.
Right.
Right.
With this new social group that you're not really part of,
right.
except you're sort of attached.
Right. And that's why I like, you know, in many ways, we encourage strongly athletes to look at, like, destination races where the partner can have a vacation too or be support. And it's not just about, you know, slugging around being a Sherpa for your fellow athlete and dragging two screaming children. They're going to be your responsibility, not the person who needs to have their feet up and be in sleep by 7:30. So it's finding opportunities. Right, exactly. Finding opportunities where you can both get something out of it.
Yeah.
I think it's just coaching them through the compromise, the compromise of life and having a partner that you've chosen. It's your choice that you're married or in a relationship. So, it's therefore important to give back. So does your partner have a passion? How can you support them in their passion?
Good point. Can
you involve them a little bit more in what it is you're doing? You know, we'll even do things like maybe you have a Sunday breakfast out with your partner and you get to run to the breakfast, but there's something that you're giving back to the relationship by having breakfast together and having some you time.
Yes.
So, you know, there's lots of clever ways to do it, but I think it's just talking it through and creating a schedule for that stuff so that it's not stuff that's just thrown in the in the bottom drawer and never addressed until everyone gets so bitter that the whole thing's a mess.
I've seen so many times over the years where somebody in the family says, hey, I'm going to do an Ironman. And then the whole family is like, hey, this guy's going to lose 30 pounds or the woman's going to lose 30 pounds. And the whole family's in, right? The kids, and you build your life around dad getting his workout and his 4-hour bike ride on the weekend. And then it's once, you know. People are giving them time off from work and doing, it's like, hey, you're going to do this once. This is a bucket list. I'm going to do this. And you know the line. As soon as they come across the finish line, it's,
another one.
I can go faster,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then the family's like, no. We gave you 12 months to right. do this. You did it. And now there's that, you know, now it's the fists hitting each other of, okay, now this person's addicted to this. They right. want more. And the right. family's like, no, this is right. a little too selfish for us. You right. deal with that at all?
All the time. All the time. Yeah. I guess it's just finding ways to satisfy that desire in that athlete.
Yes.
And again, building that compromise. And yes. so maybe it's not an Ironman every year. Maybe you'll choose one in 2 years' time, but you can still do some sprint and Olympic
local
distance.
Stuff with the family.
Exactly. Yeah. Some local 10Ks, get your kids running the mile,
yes.
all that kind of stuff. So you're still building on that desire, but it's just reframed.
So talk, Simon, about our three brains, right? Mm. We've got the chimp brain, the professor brain, the computer brain. Tell me the difference in how,
right.
how someone like myself, I think I'm all chimp. But,
Well, it starts really with a fairly simple question that we have for athletes, which is, do you ever have thoughts and feelings that you don't want? And anyone that says that they don't is lying to you, or they're on psychotropics or something. Because we all do, whether it's
sure.
about sport or life or, you know, relationships or work. And the big question that I'm interested in is, why do we have those thoughts and feelings we don't want? Why is it that I'm standing on the start line of a race and I'm terrified,
yes.
or but I want to enjoy it? Why can't I enjoy this as right. I should be?
Yes.
I know it's only a blah, 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 but I'm not enjoying it. And actually, some of the more recent research in cognitive psychology and neuroscience has given us a lot of the answers to that. And we know that our brains have evolved to have quite different functions. So, you know, your brain is much like a tree. If you were to cut it open and you were to count the rings on a tree to show how old it is, the middle part is the oldest. Your brain's exactly the same way. So the part in the middle of your brain, and scientists know this as the limbic system. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a collection of structures. And we call it a chimp because it acts like a chimp. It's paranoid and emotional. It's the fight or flight response. It's where all the pleasure centers and the fear centers are located. It's where all our impulses and drives come from. And its goal is to keep you alive, is to make sure your urges are met so that
sure.
you eat and drink and get safe and procreate.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really think rationally. It can't think. So when you think of who you are as a person and what you want to do in life and things that you enjoy and don't enjoy, that's not your limbic system that's doing that thinking. It's your frontal cortex, the wrinkly, squishy bit at the front. That's called the professor brain.
Okay.
So the professor brain, which is the real you, only thinks in using facts and logic and truth. And its goal really is to give you a sense of purpose in life. And we know it's a fairly human trait to want to find meaning in life and to have some sense of purpose,
sure.
as well as a conscience and all those sorts of things. And so we've got this. These two brains really are fighting one another.
I was going to say, they're not happy together.
Right. On the one hand, you know, Leslie's chimp brain is telling her that she's hungry and she's frustrated and she's tired. But her professor brain is telling her, but I need to be nice because Simon's going to think I'm selfish. And,
right.
you know, all the things. So she has this fight as she comes home from training.
Yes.
And we all have it. But the thing is about your chimp brain is that its goal is really quite simple. It's to keep you alive and to stop you being hurt psychologically or physically. And it'll do everything to make sure that happens. It's been given quite ancient powers to do that. It's been given some chemical weapons. We call them neurotransmitters. It dumps a load of hormones and other substances in your brain to make sure that you, when you need to, that you get out of trouble quite quickly.
Yeah.
But it doesn't know, because it was created millions and millions of years ago, the DNA of it was created millions of years ago, that it doesn't know that it's just a triathlon when your life isn't actually in danger. You're not going to get squished by a woolly mammoth or get eaten by a tiger in your sleep or so on. And this really is the ultimate source of thoughts and feelings that you don't want. So you get frustrated, you get mad, you worry that you're going to be people laughing at you, or you don't feel like an athlete, or you don't feel as though you deserve a coach, or some of those other things. And these are all chimp brain
sure.
motives to tell you that I don't want to, for whatever you do, Simon, not only are we trying to keep you alive, but we don't want you to feel humiliated, embarrassed, or inadequate. And this is really the essence of the chimp brain's manifesto.
Okay.
But of course, now we know that in most of the things in life we'd go through, that's usually not that likely to happen. Your life's rarely in danger. Yes, you might feel a little bit embarrassed, but even then, it's not necessarily a matter of life and death whether you get embarrassed. It used to be. Used to be socially isolated, you separated from the troop and you would starve and, you know, so on. But nowadays it isn't.
Stone you and
exactly,
you're dead.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now, but our professor brain, meanwhile, is thinking quite rationally. So it can't really think as though that life is like that anymore. But the trouble is that the chimp brain is so powerful, it can throw a chemical brick at your professor brain to stop it thinking rationally, and it processes information 5 times quicker than your professor brain, which is why when you're in environments that you'll pick up, you know, things that you see and hear, it'll process those as threatening before you've even had a, you know, before you can even consciously think that's happening. So you're already at a disadvantage. So when you have thoughts and feelings you don't want, actually, you've just been hijacked by your chimp. So your chimp is now in charge of you. If you ever think at any one particular time, do I want to think or feel like this right now? If the answer is no, your chimp is in charge of you without you knowing it.
Interesting.
So the goal as a sports psychologist certainly is to say all of these strategies that we have that many people know about, whether it's goal setting or visualization or stress management, the goal is simply to regain control of your own brain so that your rational thinking, logical you is now in charge and can make sensible decisions that aren't going to be governed on emotion,
right,
impulsivity, fear of humiliation, embarrassment, inadequacy. And there's many people, we have many athletes who will refuse to do certain races because they're scared of who's going to be racing, or they think that they won't have a good chance of getting on the podium and all those other things. And so we're trying to get people to say, this isn't the real you that's making this decision, it's your chimp. And so we're trying to reverse that so that you can take charge of yourself and get back to living and enjoying a happy, mundane life, you know, which is non-life-threatening.
I was interesting this morning because we were racing and it was pouring rain. Very rare for San Diego, but it was cold and it was rainy. And I was overhearing people this morning, and even for myself too, I'm there early and I'm going, well, this could be canceled. The swim could be canceled. I don't know what's going to happen today. Do I really want to be out here? I'm going to get cold. I'm going to be wet. It's like, we never have weather like this. And I could hear other people the same. It's, first of all, it's dark, right? And it's pouring rain and it's cold. And most of us aren't dealing with this. It's not a day you'd get up and go train, right? You'd go like, I'll sleep in today. I'll go to the gym. But it's a race, and you've paid for it. And so you got this battle going on. Your chimp brain is saying, I just, you know, stay home. This is silly. I could fall down. It's wet out here. I heard one guy say his wife was going to come and race, but she's doing Santa Rosa next weekend, and she's probably going to fall down because there's too many rookies doing the race, and she's going to. So, you know, her chimp brain basically told her to stay home. Mm-hmm. Or the husband was like, I paid, you know, over $100 for this. I don't care what the weather is. I'm coming out here and doing this. So he told his chimp brain, you know, screw you. I paid for this. I'm going to take advantage of this. I could just see the chimp brain and the professor brain all over the race today with people arguing with themselves. And then the other side of it is, then you've got your challenge athlete guys missing a leg and somebody else is in a hand cycle. And you could see the guys whose chimp brain were saying, and I shouldn't be racing today, but look at that guy. Look at what this guy's going through, and he's out here or she's out here racing. Okay, professor brain's going, this is something I should be doing. I shouldn't be scared. When you were out there today, you could probably, you're probably hearing all the chimp brain stuff going on.
You don't even have to hear it. You just look at people's faces.
You could
see
it,
right?
Body
language, the way they hold themselves, the way they rack their bike, you know, their shoulders are down, they keep looking up at the sky. And yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's what is the most interesting thing about this is just educating people on how their brain functions is part of the fix, because, you know, they start to understand why are they having these thoughts and feelings, and therefore they don't feel so isolated because they're like, oh, probably everyone else is feeling that too.
Exactly.
And now I know that, I don't feel so bad.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, you know, just the education piece alone is being huge for our athletes.
But I think the third piece to this is, you know, we've got this other brain that we call the computer brain, and what happens is that the computer brain thinks much quicker than even your chimp. It's actually the lightning fast, and it's where all our habits and routines are kept, and a lot of our memories are kept. Mm-hmm. And And the interesting thing is that when we learn by association, so memories are really associative, as we say. So we are in a certain environment and we see certain sounds or smells, and that reminds us and brings up memories of things. And so some athletes might see the rain, and if you've never been to a triathlon or never done a triathlon before, you just think, oh, it's going to be wet and cold. But if you've been to those athletes, those races before, and you've said, well, I don't actually ever perform well in the wet, or my bike handling isn't very good in the wet. And so it brings up all these memories, and it's convincing your chimp brain and fueling it and stoking the fire that you shouldn't be there and you should go home and you shouldn't do this. And so what we're trying to do is not just wrestle control back to your professor, is to also sort of, you know, interject in those memories, or that computer brain is feeding you this illogical nonsense, and negative. To say, you know what, it doesn't have to be, because it happened in the past, it doesn't happen have to happen again. And so we're trying to sort of intercept that as well.
So when in the book, 13 Most Common Mental Conundrums Athletes Face in Everyday, give me an idea of
the kinds of
conundrum.
Yeah, so we were quite eager not to mention problems or issues, because that makes it also as though that you've got a problem. And one thing we know is that most athletes deal with this sort of stuff on a daily basis.
Sure.
This is probably more common than feeling confident, calm and collected, you know. And what we wanted to do was to try and identify them through our coaching. We said, you know, athletes come to us on a fairly consistent basis with these sorts of issues.
Sure.
So we didn't pick these out of, you know, a textbook. We said, look, if we could write down what the most common things that athletes tell us that they want help with, what would they be? And then, so this is really where these came from. So things like, I feel fat.
So body image
issues.
Yeah.
One of them was, I need to harden the F up, meaning, and what athletes were meant by that usually was they throw in the towel too early, or when it really starts to hurt, they kind of quit and so on. Another one was, I don't really feel like an athlete. You know, I don't feel worthy of an athlete. So the thoughts and feelings you have about your identity as an athlete and how we make you feel like it. So you look in the mirror and not, you don't just see an athlete, but you feel like one on the inside too. So we were trying to come at it or meet the athletes exactly where they are for the kinds of issues like that they face, rather than say, here's a book on how to use goal setting or how to use visualization or how to use stress management. Athletes don't come to you and say, I need to get more psychological and emotional strength to run a half marathon. They say, you know what, I just quit too much, or I need to harden up, or I just don't, you know. So I think that trying to approach these issues exactly how they appear in the heads of athletes was quite important to us. And then we unpack them from the psychology of it, but we also look at strategies to sort of deal with them, as well as some case studies that we've worked with, or our own athletes are in this book. We've changed their names so we don't embarrass the heck out of them, but that our own athletes are in how we've dealt with these very issues that they cope with. This is the kind of stuff we've done with them, and this is why it works.
When you mention that, Mark Allen, you know, six-time Ironman world champion, when he was a swimmer in college at UCSD, and he had this tendency when he was racing that if anybody passed him, if anybody got in front of him, he gave up. Never came from behind to beat anybody. That was just his MO. That's what he was. He gave up. So the first USTS triathlon, United States Triathlon Series event in Del Mar, there was a guy off the front by the name of Dave Scott, and there was two guys named Scott Tindley and Scott Molina who were running with Mark Allen in second, third, and fourth. And then there was a point in the run, now it was a 15K run, where Mark Allen was passed by a guy named Dale Basescu. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, he was like, well, there it goes again. I got passed. I'll give up. And then all of a sudden, he came back and passed Dale Basescu. And when he finished the race in fourth place, is ironic, with Dave Scott, Scott Molina, Scott Tindley, Mark Allen, top four in the first ever USTS race, it changed his perception of himself from a guy who gave up in this sport. I didn't give up. In this sport, I was able to dig deep and come back to take fourth place. So maybe this sport is good for me. And those are the type of things you look at?
Exactly. So that's a great example of where your computer brain is telling you, you never do well. When this happens, then you might as
giving
well.
Giving up.
Right.
Yeah.
And the way to, and ironically, the way that you overcome this stuff is, yes, you can read about some strategy of the brain, but you actually have to push through it.
Right.
You have to face some adversity and you have to come out the other side. And so one of the things that we do in our coaching business certainly is that we force athletes to stare adversity in the face. We give them training sessions where they think, there's no way I can get this done. And it's not because we're trying to push your physical limits. It's we're trying to get you to a point where you mentally approach situations or training sessions with the mindset that I don't think this is possible. You try anyway, and you get to where you get, but you come out the other side, and the world often looks different than when you started, training-wise. Yeah. And that's such a key mental shift for athletes to be able to, and we know that all the research on how self-confidence works, you improve these things by facing the adversity, coping with it, coming out the other side, and that's how you redraw the boundary of what's possible for you. There's really no other way to do it. So you can't learn your way to heart to mental toughness. You have to earn it.
When you say that, I from interviewing Chrissy Wellington and Greg Welch and different athletes over the years, they would talk about sessions that Brett Sutton would create for them that would just sound ridiculous, right? I remember Siri Lindley telling me some of the things that they were doing, and you're thinking, there's no way I could ever do this. And then you finish it, and you've changed your perception of you, of what you can and can't do. And somebody else believed in you before you did. And you probably see that every day.
Absolutely. And it's not just good coaching, it's good science. I mean,
yes.
The neuroscience shows, you know, scientists have this rather fancy name called neuroplasticity. And what it means is the brain physically changes in response to adversity.
Yes.
It really says, you know, your brain, the synapses, the way that the nerves fire. I mean, it really says to you that once you've done something that you didn't think you could do, and it thinks it's going to be asked to do that again. How do I physically change so that this becomes less arduous in the future? And this happens in a matter of weeks. And so giving athletes the opportunity to experience this, you're not just getting them to build confidence. You're physically changing the way that their brain is processing information about hardship. And that's critical.
Love it. Leslie, give me an example of when you, with all this study that you guys have done and where you put this into operation and had success on a race day where you sort of knew what was going on, dealt with it, and created success from it.
Sure. I mean, again, that 2012 second title was where I created it. So that summer, we really got back to the basics of why I do this sport. So I chose mental toughness sessions, but I chose them in areas that I love. So I went out to Palomar Mountain. I went out to the Laguna Mountains. All of these places that make me feel great.
Yes.
But and put me in a wonderful place to then challenge myself and come up with pretty tough sessions. Not only that, go out with training partners, where a huge part was a social environment, because that's always what's made me tick as a youngster. I have a lot of memories, good memories for that. And then building this alter ego. So practicing it in training. I started to build my character up. I would walk like my character. I would train like my character. I would get off the bike like my character. I would speak like my character. All of these kinds of things. So that when it came to race day, I had all of those in place. We did some things like I knew the negative thoughts that would come up. And we do what's called the 10 and 10 countering, where you have the top 10 things that you know are going to pop into your head during a race that are negative, and you counter them with, you know,
ten
positives, yeah.
Yes.
And I took, you know, three or four of the real big ones, and I wrote those on my forearms. So
and
that
what
was
were they?
Be brave. So have the courage to, you know,
to make
deal with
go off the front or whatever it happens.
Yeah,
to
you know, or just deal with the expectation.
Right.
And gosh, I can't even remember the other one.
About freedom.
Oh, freedom. Yeah, just let it all go. Just you've done the work, let your body do what it knows how to do and enjoy the experience. And it's probably one of the first races of my life that I loved every minute of it. It was poetic and I mastered everything within that race. And that's still, I'm so proud of that moment.
So
just that
was probably your best race?
Yeah, ever. Definitely.
And from that point, I remember when Chrissy Wellington finished and won the 2011 Ironman after crashing and not knowing she'd get to the starting line. I mean, she never raced again. She was basically dropped the mic. That was it. That was my greatest race ever. Did you feel that way after that race? Or sort of
no,
like,
I felt addicted to it.
Wanted more. Yeah, I want more of that.
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
Yeah, that would be. When looking at some of the athletes that you've dealt with, when I think of the pro cyclists, we had such that long era of drug use, right, with the top pro cyclists. And now, you know, when I read the books, Tyler Hamilton's book and some of the other books, you don't think of those guys as insecure, but they're all thinking, well, everybody else is doing it. Mm-hmm. And I can't, I'm physically great, but I can't do it. Do you look at that as part of
Absolutely.
Why that era was so all-consuming? Every cyclist felt, I need to do, I can't just do it with what I'm, you know, is it, what, Paniagua, right? Mm-hmm. With just bread and water. I need what those guys are doing or else I'm just not good enough.
Absolutely. I mean, the motivation to take drugs is a chimp brain problem.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the fact that any logical person, not just one that, you know, thinks about, you know, the health consequences, but also the ethical and moral issues of
sure.
it, come to the conclusion that it's a terrible idea to do. But our chimp brains are five times stronger and five times quicker. So it's a terrible thing to try and fight. And then when these sorts of things are institutionalized in sports, so that it's not just the riders in the case of cycling or other sports, just the athletes, it's the management and it's the organization, it's the sponsors. They all want these things. It's all feeding into it. You just
sure.
do it. It's almost an impossible, you know, being a professional cyclist in the 80s and 90s, it's mind-boggling to think how you even confront or how you try and struggle with the pressure to do that, not just from your own chimp, but from everybody else's chimp as well. It's quite remarkable.
Well, and especially when, you know, the people at the top of the game are basically not looking or not caring because there's a lot of money being created and a lot of excitement being created. So why rock the boat?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, you know, all the pleasure centers in our brain that tell us how great we are and what things feel good and the chance of fame and fortune, they're all chimp brain motifs and urges. And so when we feed into that and we create a culture that gets reinforced, it's a tremendously difficult thing to overcome. And which is why you can't recuse athletes' responsibility for making that decision, but you can understand it a little bit more.
Oh, no
question.
Because
it's a much bigger context.
Well, I look at it from a perspective. If I was somebody who had success in the United States and thought, okay, now where the real money is, track and field, cycling, I'm going to go to Europe because that's where the real money is. And then you get over there and realize that, okay, and you're a high school graduate, and you go over there and you realize, oh, this is what I have to do to be at to be the best and to be able to rationalize my contract and the rest of that. Your options are A, you come back to the States and work at Starbucks or be a mechanic, or you do what everybody else is doing because it seems like everybody's everybody's ignoring it. So it seems like this is accepted behavior.
And it's just, I mean, this is just highlighted in the top end of the pointy end of the sport, but we're seeing this more now in age group.
Because
if you think about, you know, the chimp brain mentality, we all have chimp brains and the desire to be have some notoriety or to win or to be faster than other people is pretty endemic. So I think that mentality, this is why people will cut the course and marathons,
yes.
and they've got nothing to gain from it, and we roll our eyes and scratch our heads about how do people want to do that, what motivates them to do it when there's really no tangible gain for them. It's the fact that we've really let our chimp brains run amok and we haven't really been able to hijack the control back into thinking, you know, well, why are we doing this and why are we still feel so motivated to prove ourselves compared to others. So
yes. So this is a very unique book. We get a lot of the sort of same topic type of books, you know, how do you improve yourself and how do you go faster and how do you use a power meter, and blah, blah, blah. I love the fact that this is all stuff I've never heard before. It's very, very unique. What are you proudest of with this book? Because I know this is a labor of love. You're working on movies at the same time. You're coaching your athletes. But in the meantime, you're putting something together that's pretty novel. What are you proudest of?
Well, I think for the big for us, there's lots of things that you can learn and take away from the book. But the big message of this is, and we talk about this in the introduction. There's a lovely a quote from an old Scottish theologian. It says is really about everyone is fighting a battle that you know nothing about. So just be kind, right?
Right.
And the nice thing about this is because it really opens, it peeks behind the curtain of the psychology of the athlete from the age grouper to the professional. It says, listen, we're on these 13 issues that you probably, if you're a competing and training athlete, you'll probably identify with three or four of them right off the bat.
Sure.
And to know that many athletes are thinking this isn't just you.
No.
So I didn't realise that other athletes, surely Leslie Patterson doesn't feel fat. Of course she does. And so I think that having this reaching out, and we know, for example, that people bond and feel good and communicate and feel trusted based on vulnerability and weaknesses rather than strengths. And so it's really a little window to people's vulnerability and weaknesses. And it's just sharing them and say, listen, we're acknowledging them. And how do we, here are some tangible strategies that we can all use to help us feel better, happier and more confident in sport, but in life. And I think that's the big message for us.
So an English guy likes a quote from a Scotsman. Is that what you're telling me?
I have to, because I'm married to a Scotsman.
Okay. So for you, Les, what are you proudest of with the book?
I think that we've really unpacked the science behind how the brain works from an approachable standpoint, and then come up with solutions. You know, a lot of these sports psych books out there, they don't really come up with...
No, they just identify stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've come up with proper homework for you to do that's fun and engaging and different.
And you were the guinea pig.
And I was a guinea pig. Exactly.
She's not just the guinea pig, but she came up with many of them. Because as we said, this is really a hybrid of the psychology of... the science of sports psychology and the real life and head of a professional athlete. And where those two worlds meet is where this book starts.
That is so cool.
Boom.
Boom. If we could drop these mics, I think we would.
I know.
Thank you both for coming in studio. That's really fit. Oh, no. I love what you guys do. Again, the book is called The Brave Athlete, Calm the F Down and Rise to the Occasion. And it's 13 most common mental conundrums athletes face in every day. How long do you guys sit down and go, okay, we don't want to say problems, we don't want to say issues.
That's right.
What, finding that word, conundrum, which
hey,
is...
Sai's got a PhD, come on now.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, it has a few syllables in it. Yeah. Love that. I love that.
So I'm guessing
that Leslie came up with calm the F down.
Well, this is her life mantra, right?
It is. Thank you. And it's funny because our producer was like, listen, I'm going back and forth between baseball and here. Please don't drop any F-bombs. I'm like, okay, I can't guarantee that. But fortunately, we did. Fine. Thanks, you guys, for coming
Thanks,
in.
Bo.
I appreciate it. Again,
pleasure.
We are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott. The IOA Run the City 5K coming up on Thursday, June 15th at Liberty Station. RunTheCity5K.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, ChallengedAthletes.org. Definitely go online and sign up for our San Diego Triathlon Challenge, where Leslie Patterson will be with us. That is coming up on Sunday, October 22nd, a one-mile swim, a 44-mile bike, 10-mile run, and we'll have over 140 challenge athletes from all over the world there. Check out all of our interviews on Babbittville.com, on iTunes. Subscribe to our Endurance World newsletter. And as always, stay tuned, because we got more interviews coming up, and endurance lives here.